Hello, I'm the Duchess of Rutland. I'm so excited to be back with you for another season of Duchess, and this one will be extra special. I'm so grateful I've been able to travel around the country, see beautiful houses, and meet extraordinary people. But I've wanted to finally bring you inside and share all the magic we have here at our very own home, Beaver Castle. So in this six-part limited season, we are exploring my home, Grantham's Great Jewel. Bringing you every piece of its history, art, and culture, all of its past, its present, and the future. So I hope you enjoy this very special season. This is Duchess. Last week on the podcast, we had a fantastic episode. I met Tom Webster, Beaver Castle's head gardener, to talk about the gorgeous gardens we have here at the property. I also spoke to Olivia Jogu about the ghosts and legends of Beaver. Be sure to check that episode out if you haven't already. This week on the podcast, we're exploring two very special subjects, our treasured art and heirlooms and the interiors of Beaver Castle. Later on the podcast, I will be meeting managing directors of Sybil Colfax, Emma Burns and Philip Hooper to discuss the history and design of Beaver's interiors. But first, I meet Orlando Rock, chairman of the historic auctioneering house Christie's. When it comes to identifying splendid works of art and understanding the history associated with them, I doubt there is anyone more qualified than Orlando. Places like Beaver have been crafted over generations to home works of art. The continuity of time and the resources of the families that owned homes like these have made them a literal treasure trove. And today we're going to dive in. In our conversation, Orlando and I go through our favourite pieces and their historical significance. I ask Orlando how you actually determine the value of an antique, and Orlando explains why it's important to preserve these works for future generations. Orlando, tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, I'm an architectural enthusiast. I'm a furniture specialist. I'm chairman of Christie's in London, and I have a particular obsession with the English country house.
Now, just for our listeners, to set the scene of this unbelievable connection that you have, being the head of Christie's, also with heritage, where do you live, Orlando?
So I'm a sort of a neighbour of Beaver. So my wife's family comes from Burley House near Stamford, which is about 25 minutes away. So we have a rather wonderful kind of proximity and a shared interest in preserving houses with wonderful treasures that we want to open to the public and preserve for the future.
So, of course, we know that stately homes are deeply associated with valuable art. But what historically has made it possible for estates like Beaver to accumulate such works?
Gosh, well, every house has a completely different history, I suppose, in many ways. I mean, I think that the single biggest event in the history of the English country house is the dissolution of the monasteries and the redistribution of wealth under Henry VIII that took place at that time for his loyal courtiers. And really, that was the foundation of many of the greatest dynastic houses now. And in some ways, it's perhaps the closest parallel is the redistribution of national wealth in Russia to the oligarchs in the late 1990s. It was a seismic shift in this redistribution of wealth. So I think there's interesting parallels there, except it survived now for 500 years in the Beavers and the Burleys and the Chatsworths and all these incredible houses, which are really based on that. If you were a great lawyer, it was very important. If you were very astute politically and you managed to keep on the right side of the changing fortunes of different monarchs, that was fundamental. Agricultural wealth was fundamental. And most importantly, and rather cynically, strategic marriages were fundamental to allowing houses like Beaver to accumulate incredible works of art.
Fascinating. And I have to say, I always remind myself, what did I bring of any great works of art into the marriage? I brought a Welsh dresser, a Welsh table and six chairs. So I don't think David didn't marry me for my artistic wealth.
But also a fantastic singing voice and energy.
energy.
And that is what really makes the difference.
Within the archives of stately homes, we often see the phrase, the Grand Tour. What was the Grand Tour, Orlando, and how are they significant to the people who went on them?
The Grand Tour really started in the 17th century, and it was the sort of completion of really an adult education. It was an exposure to the art and architecture of ancient Rome, and it was also a way of educating the sort of young milordis who were taken to the rather more decadent flesh pots of Italy, as well as the great churches and the great buildings. And I mean, it's very interesting when you look at houses with Grand Tour collections, which so many of them have now got the remains of things that were bought, where really they came into their adult maturity. And they often travelled, I mean, from the 17th century, certainly the 5th Earl of Exeter, who was a great Grand Tourist, actually, he travelled with a huge retinue and with his wife. He went on 3 Grand Tours, and he was the daughter of the manors girl, and bought assiduously. And Beaver is a similar, you know, example of great Grand Tourists buying wonderful works of art and then trying to create often Italianate rooms in the middle of England, which is always rather a surprise to me. Some of them work quite well. The 5th Earl bought a whole room full of 17th century tiles, which he then decided to make in a north-facing room in Lincolnshire, which was probably not a great idea. But other great treasures that came and marbles and things commissioned, you know, tell the story of their travels and where they went. And Beaver, of course, has got that incredible archive room. So actually, you can trace the history of objects and where they were bought and who they met and who they saw. And I think that's what's so incredible. That's why we know that the Broussards and Cardinal Dal Pozzo and, you know, all of that link to purchasing in Italy.
So as we know, and I so remember this when you first came up all those years ago, valuing works of art can be a very tricky business. What makes Beaver significant and special when it comes to identifying values of works of art?
I mean, Beaver's such an incredible treasure house, and there are so many extraordinary things in every possible field. But I think what really makes Beaver stand out, quite apart from the quality of the pictures, is the documented records which allow one to unpick the layers. I mean, I'll never forget going to those wonderful Dusty archives and finding the original payments for the dining room furniture and a lot of the furniture in the bedrooms, which was done very much in the Regency kind of avant-garde taste to really underline the close relationship between the Prince Regent and the Duke of Rutland at the time. And we found the original bills from Morell and Hughes. We had the carving by Bogart. We knew when they were supplied in 1811. And that was just, you know, gave you everything you needed to know. I mean, those Brusselon chairs in the picture gallery, and I'll never forget those as a set of 6 that were bought by the 5th Duke. But the other ones are with Byron at Newstead Abbey and with Walter Scott at Abbotsford. Now, I couldn't get more romantic, and they came from the Borghese Palace. But without the archives and that record, you wouldn't know the history of where they'd been before. So that really adds huge luster to their appeal.
So paintings are always some of the most valuable items in stately homes, Orlando. What, in your mind, are some of our most valuable paintings at Beaver?
Gosh, well, like any great, great house, Beaver has got a run of family portraits, which really documents the history of the family. And there are some sublime pictures, particularly the group of Reynolds, all commissioned by the family. A lot of the 19th century acquisitions, I think, are particularly special, but it's really the 18th century I focus on. I mean, I think of those glorious Gainsborough landscapes, which are sublime. I think of the extraordinary group of Stubbses, which, you know, knowing the names of the dogs, I think one's called Turk, isn't it? And these just sensational images of dogs. You've got the incredible Dutch pictures of the Jan Steens. There are the incredible series of Teniers pictures. So, I mean, you are so rich in the number of things you've got. I get distracted, of course, by the works of art. So I think that extraordinary Elizabethan silver gilt, extraordinary rosewater dish and basin, which is one of the great treasures in England, anywhere. I mean, it's so unbelievably rare. Again, not melted down. The great state bed. I mean, everywhere you look, there are treasures. The one I love, which always confuses me, is this fantastic series of Gobelin tapestries
in the Regent's
Gallery, aren't they? And those, which were a royal gift from Louis XVI to the Duc de la Vrillière, but of course they have the peacock woven into the border at the top. So of course they were a perfect purchase for a manors with the family crest at the top. And so if you walked into that house, you would automatically assume that they would have been commissioned directly by the family. But of course, when you go in and find the history, they're even more interesting.
And the history was fascinating, because what was happening at France at the time of the building of Beaver?
The English tourists and aristocrats loved to travel to Paris, but of course the Napoleonic Wars were incredibly complicated. There was a very brief window, the Peace of Amiens and around 1802, where they could go in and buy French works of art, many of which had been sort of freed from the French royal palaces during the Revolution. So there was a great opportunity to buy great things. And then after the defeat of Napoleon, there was this again, this huge surge of interest in all things French. And so around 1815, 1816, 1817, which is exactly the time when all the great changes architecturally going on at Beaver, was a great time to buy French works of art. And of course, not only works of art, but also panelling. So I think the Madame de Maton panelling was put in for the earliest French white and gold drawing room in England. You know, it changed the course of history and taste in the country.
And I remember, I think it was Tim Knox saying to me when he was helping me with my book about Beaver, how we had one of the most amazing collection of Nollekin busts in the Regent's Gallery.
Yeah, they're absolutely astonishing. And really, it's like walking into the Regency period, because you have these familiar faces, all of the key figures of the day in these busts in marble for posterity.
And the Regency period, just for our listeners again, was quite revolutionary in itself, wasn't it? Was it the first time that you were really sitting down in a dining room? Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it really changed the way that the court behaved. I mean, effectively, the Regency comes from George, Prince of Wales, who had a slightly uncomfortable relationship with his father. And he set up a separate court at Carlton House and then at Brighton. And then he went on to transform Windsor and Buckingham Palace in the grandest possible way. And he was a great, great intimate of the Duke of Rutland and the Duchess. And so in many ways, what you've got at Beaver is a sort of echoing of the grandeur of what was created at the most extravagant moments in the Regency period. And in fact, some of the cabinet makers like Louis Le Gainier and Gillows and Wyatt as an architect were the same people who the Prince Regent went to for his own architectural improvements.
How should historic homes display their work, do you believe, Orlando? And should we be honouring the sensibilities of the past or focus on the future?
Because I'm so interested in archival documents, I'm always accused by Miranda of being rather slavish in wanting to reconstruct where things were originally placed. And actually, over the passage of time, with architectural changes, you can't often put pictures back for where they were first commissioned or bits of furniture where they were going to be. And symmetry is a kind of divisive word in our household, because, of course, everyone was bound to symmetry in the past. But of course, that's changed now in terms of how people look at it. I think it's a very difficult balance in terms of, you know, I believe that people should use and enjoy the works of art we have, and houses really come alive when there are families living around them and enjoying them. And I think that's the lifeblood of privately owned heritage, and that's why they're so special and people want to come and see them. So I don't believe in wearing kind of protective gloves and not touching things. I think one should use chests of drawers and one should enjoy all those things. I mean, having said that, conservation is important. Ideally, if one can have a kind of rolling program of gently conserving things, not restoring things. There's a fundamental difference between invasive restoration, which actually can have very long-term detrimental effects. And it's amazing when you go to some houses where, unfortunately, there was perhaps slightly too much money at a certain period of time, and there was an over-assiduous picture restorer who basically relined and cleaned every picture within an inch of its life. And actually, a bit of benign neglect has been a very good thing. I mean, many of the great things survived because they weren't interfered with in the 19th century and in the early 20th century, when science and techniques were not quite there. But I think now we're in a much better place on conservation. So maintaining things is important, but also looking forward, we need to kind of make sure that houses are fit for purpose and that they are somewhere that you can have the demands, whether it's of filming or of events, you know, all the things that really provide the income that keep the roof on. They have to be able to work with that. So it's a balance.
I love that word. Balance is key for heritage, isn't it? So we've spoken so far about historic pieces of art or furniture, but when it comes to custodians of stately homes in the modern day, we rarely see people bolstering their collections with fresh and exciting contemporary art. Why do you think this is? And should we as custodians be doing more to add modern pieces to our collection?
It's such an interesting debate, this, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it at all. When we look at houses, we celebrate the bold, the brave, the spendthrift, the extravagant, and grasped the avant-garde and did radical things and knocked down houses and rebuilt things, and the ones who are completely out of control quite often. But those are the things that we really get excited by when we look around houses, because they were the ones who really decided to change the direction of travel. And now we're in this phase of preservation. We lose some of that energy and some of that creative spirit and patronage. And I think we've also got planning laws, which are very protective and very sensible on one level. But, you know, there is no way that Beaver could have been rebuilt four times if planning laws had been around. So it is an interesting balance how we make houses relevant to future generations. And some houses have been incredibly brave in doing that. One of the things that holds one back is that, you know, particularly a house like Beaver, which has got such treasures there, you know, you would have to make space for new things by putting old things in storage or dispersing of them to fund new adventures. And I think that that is a difficult thing, because can you be certain that what you will commission now will stand the test of time and will be of a sufficient caliber and quality? But we also need to have an eye to the future too, I think. I mean, I think what's wonderful is when you can carry on a tradition within a collection, but also expand it a little bit. So I loved the De Gournay wallpaper project that you've been doing, because actually that really is building on those incredible 18th century hand painting Chinese wallpapers and all the lacquer in the bedrooms, but for a totally 21st century audience. So that carries on a theme.
And that's something we live with every day, isn't it? We still have to live in these buildings and make them practical, and yet we have to preserve. And it's a balance every day, we find.
I think it is a balance every day. And I think that if there's something worth preserving, which is magical and is sufficiently sort of retrievable, then it's always worth doing that. But I think one should always also think about how one is letting a collection evolve so it remains relevant to people in the future.
Thank you, Orlando. Fascinating. Final question, Orlando. It is such a privilege living in heritage, isn't it? Every day waking up and being surrounded by pure magic and the views that we have through windows that have been looked out of for generations by other members of our family. What's your very favourite piece at Burley?
Gosh, I get distracted all the time because there are so many interesting things there. But there's something I'm very, very attached to, which may turn out to be a spectacular 18th century fake. I'm not entirely sure, but it's a really beautiful carved marble lion that was, we know from the archival records, was bought on the Grand Tour by the 9th Earl. And it was dug up in the mud of the Tiber in 1732. And it's just got this incredibly sort of ferocious, fierce lion with this wonderful drilled hair and these incredible curls around the mane. And of course, the lion is the supporter for the Cecil coat of arms. So it appealed perfectly to the 9th Earl on the Grand Tour, and it's meant to be Roman and it's meant to be an imperial treasure. Now, many people feel that it may be actually rather closer to the work of someone called Cavacepi, who specialised in selling Grand Tour antiquities to the unsuspecting dilettanti who were visiting on the Grand Tour. But for me, in terms of the association of the history, the Tiber, the mud, and this kind of wonderful remnant of the Cecil lion dug up from the mud, I just love that thing. But there are too many treasures to choose from, I'm sure. Well, your favourite at Beaver, what would yours be?
So my absolute go-to every day that I live in that building is the marble figure of Elizabeth. So I have got the living example of the lady who commissioned the castle, worked throughout her life to build the castle that's been left with us today. And if I ever have a moment, Orlando, when I have to just rejig myself and say, come on, you can do this, I go and have a quiet chat to her and say, Elizabeth, now what? And she's with me every day.
Oh, that's such a poignant memorial, isn't it? Really special.
Lovely. Orlando, it's been an honour and pleasure to have you with us. Orlando Rock, Chairman of Christie's, what a lucky team they are to have you heading them up.
Well, how lovely to be here today. Thank you very much.
God bless you.
Your carriage awaits. The countdown to Christmas is on as the clock strikes 12 on the 18th of November 2022. Beaver Castle will be transformed into a breathtaking Cinderella-themed scene. Wander through the lavishly decorated spaces for an unforgettable family Christmas experience. For tickets, visit beavercastle.com. Now let's move our conversation over to the interiors. Recently, we've been lucky enough to refurbish a number of rooms, known as the Howard Suite, with the aid of both teams at Sybil Colfax and De Gournay. And I'm absolutely delighted to welcome joint managing directors of Sybil Colfax, Emma Burns and Philip Hooper. It's a real joy to have you both with me. Could you start off by telling us a bit about who you both are and what your relationship to Beaver is?
I originally trained as an architect, and so architecture has always fascinated me, and particularly historic architecture. And then I made the jump and started to work within the interior design world. I particularly enjoy working on projects which have got amazing historical detail and fantastic proportions and some kind of heritage, rather than working on sort of new things. And obviously, to be invited to sort of help look at Beaver and to work on a particular suite of bedrooms and hopefully some more work in the future has been an absolute joy as well, because the house is fantastic. You know, it really is a sort of time capsule of perfect Regency interiors married with fantastic architecture.
And I too really enjoy working on any historic building, and obviously somewhere like Beaver, which, you know, having read about Beaver for years, having read Dana Cooper's memoir, etc., you know, it's so exciting to see things firsthand and also behind the scenes in a building like Beaver, where there's another whole sort of life going on of how the place actually runs, as well as the lovely bits that we all see.
So you see the very upstairs, downstairs world that Beaver still has.
Exactly, which is fascinating.
So within the interiors and design of Beaver, you can see the march of time. Can you give me your overview of the history of Beaver's interior design?
Well, it feels very much as if it's grown like Topsy. As you say, it's quite disparate in places, isn't it? And you go from very grand, large spaces to much more intimate ones. And some of the spaces almost feel quite exterior inside, and then one ends up in the very beautiful salon, which is so sort of French and exquisitely detailed. And when you consider that in the countryside with the landscape outside, and often quite a bleak landscape, I think everything to do with Beaver is about showing strength and power, and yet at the same time bringing comfort to the people who are inside. So the variations of the decoration are particularly interesting, because I think they must reflect all of the very strong Chatelaines with their strong point of view about how this castle should be run.
I think the other fascinating thing about Beaver is from an interior decoration point of view, is the history it's got with Chinese paper, which clearly brings us round to where we first met with the reimagining of the paper for the Howard Suite by de Gournay. But looking back, you know, clearly the papers predate a lot of those Regency interiors, and they've been probably brought over in the sort of early part of the 18th century to sit around until the time was right to use them. And so from a point of view of looking at a sort of Regency building, you've got all these different elements, because Regency wasn't just one style. It was neoclassical, it was Gothic, it was neo-Japanese, it was neo-Chinese, some of it was Indian. And so you've got little elements of that all through the castle that you can pick up on and see. And it's fascinating that one building holds all those different elements within it, and cohesively as well.
Philip, can you talk about how historically trade and travel could have impacted design and taste throughout the past?
I think a lot of it appeals to natural human curiosity at looking at other cultures and things. It's almost impossible to perceive what a shock it would have been to start seeing Chinese porcelain, Chinese furniture, Chinese lacquer work, Chinese paper starting to filter through into the Western market. And I think it's completely understandable that once you see something new and exciting like that, you want to have a part of that in your world. I think we have that ourselves as well now. And I think it's a shame that a lot of that comes now from just looking at images in books or on the internet, because when I first started work, part of my way of working was to actually have a little mini sabbatical for a month, and I would take myself off to India and get inspired. And I think people will have done that 200 years ago, 150 years ago as well as physically bringing the objects back and putting them into their homes.
If you think about all the grand tourists going around and stocking up, and I'm always amazed at how the pieces managed to travel back. If you think of the circumstances, you know, what they loaded onto wagons packed up with straw, and yet these fantastically delicate or very heavy pieces make their way across Europe and arrive safely and are there for everyone to see.
And a lot of, I suppose, thinking about it, a lot of the inspiration, they had to come back within their mind's eye.
Yes.
Because there were no mobile phones, no cameras.
Oh, but little sketchbooks, of course.
Little sketchbooks.
And watercolours and things like that they would have done.
So one of the great things I love here at Beaver, Emma, is the ceiling in the state dining room, which
yes.
is a direct copy of the ceiling in Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome.
Oh,
and so you
divine.
Can visualize John and Elizabeth actually visiting that church in Rome and thinking to themselves, that is exactly what we're going to have in our home. But it must have taken some sketch to copy that, because all the rosettes on that ceiling, every single one is different.
Amazing.
So Emma, if I could ask you, what for you are some of the most impressive design features here at Beaver?
I have to say one of the rooms I like the most is the library. It's got the most incredible atmosphere, hasn't it? It feels as a real sort of space of information and learning, and also a place that you'd like to spend a lot of time just lying on a sofa, flicking through your book.
And if I ask you that question, Philip?
I find the Gothic chapel absolutely exquisite. It really lifts you when you go in there, and you can understand why Gothic was considered to be the most divine of all the different sort of styles that could be adopted. You know, the carving and the sort of perpendicularness of it all, I just find wonderful, and the colours are very quiet and very peaceful as well. So it is a wonderfully sort of spiritual room. And the other room I do find exciting from a design point of view, and particularly decoration, is the Regent's Gallery. It's got that completely crazy red carpet, all with the white lilies.
With the
arum lilies all over it, which I just think is fantastic. And, you know, you have to admire the bravery of someone to say, well, yes, we've got this vast, vast gallery divided into sort of three sections, one with a bay window and then two wings on either side, and we're going to cover the whole lot in this crazy carpet. It is just inspired.
And most probably quite out there when it was done.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we always underestimate how daring things were.
Because I think people were much more brave, weren't they? If you think about the colours, where often when you see a restored interior and the ceiling's been restored and you sort of slightly almost back away and you think, wow, hold on, have they got this right? But actually when you do a sort of proper scrape of things and you find that the colours were really very strong and bold, and of course lighting was so different, wasn't it? We have got endless electric light and now we're always trying to find a softer, warmer light. But before, when people were dependent on candlelight or gaslight or whatever, you know, those colours would have been kind of calmer and they would have needed to have been stronger to stand up.
So coming back to the present, if we may now, the teams in Sybil Colfax have now put their magical touch on Beaver forever, to be recorded in our archives and to go into the history books. Tell us about the design work that you have done here.
We were obviously very much led by the beautiful paper that de Gournay had designed based on the paper at Beaver, but with this amazing new colourway. And we wanted to find fabrics that would sit happily with that, that would be strong enough to stand up to it, but not to take away from it. And also for the room not to look as if it had been recently done up, but that it had evolved like all the other rooms in the castle. And previously, the posts at the foot of the bed had been covered with curtains, and we were longing to see those posts in the room. So we decided that the hangings would be at the head of the bed, and obviously a beautiful testa and everything else, and the bed itself would be covered with a wonderful bedspread, but that you would see the sort of sculptural quality of the bed within the room. The room's an interesting volume. It's not a huge room, but it's tall, and that was another element that we needed to deal with. And so the idea of the Italian strung curtains came from that, so that we could bring the treatment of the window down into the room and yet feel generous. And those curtains, which we kept unlined, the light can sort of filter through, but then for the evening time, a pair of drawer curtains behind each, so you could have the blackout. So they're sort of balancing the practicality with the elegance and the beauty and the sort of soaring height of the room, which I think, again, those curtains really exaggerate.
What was really appealing, Emma, to you about working with Beaver on this project?
The fact that the room will be there for a very long time. I think it will only get more lovely over the years as the curtains perhaps fade and as more people have stayed in the room. And it's terribly satisfying, I think, bringing order to chaos. And whilst the room wasn't chaotic remotely before, it was a very different room before. And it's exciting to have been able to transform it. And also, I think, bring it more into the fold of the other bedrooms. I think it now feels very much part of the sort of bedroom suites, while still having its own identity. It's always thrilling to work in outstanding surroundings.
It surely is. And it always takes me back to the memory I had of my dear mother-in-law passing me that big box of keys just as she left the castle and said, good luck. And I think it's been a lot of luck, and mainly luck, and a lot of mistakes, may I say, as well, through the journey of my time here. And with experts like yourselves guiding me, it makes for a much easier way forward. So one of the things that visitors are struck with is this enormous sense of scale here at Beaver. I know you both decorated some enormous houses. What are the pros and cons of decorating a large home like Beaver?
I think you need to have confidence. And I think if you're timid about how you go about things, then that timidity will manifest itself in a very poor way of decorating. I think you've really got to take the bull by the horns and realise that, yes, we're dealing with a vast scale here. And as we just said, on the colours of the paper, you can turn the volume up. You can be much bolder with the colours because a large volume can take it. From my point of view, the rhythm of the curtains, the way in which they form enfilades and the sort of spaces link in together is an absolute joy because it brings up the best in me in terms of understanding historic proportion and things. And I think interiors and proportion and architecture and decorations come together in a very sort of homogeneous way, which is incredibly pleasing. You know, just because something is very big doesn't mean you can't sort of approach it in the same way that you approach something very small. It's all about getting the proportions right, but it's also about making people comfortable, getting the lighting right, making sure there's somewhere to sit, there's somewhere to put your feet up. And it doesn't matter whether you're dealing with, you know, a modest apartment in Pimlico or whether you're dealing with something on the proportions of Beaver. It's about understanding what the human needs are and making someone comfortable when they're there.
If I can turn this question to you, Emma, one constant tension that exists when decorating these homes is striking the balance between beauty and function. Could you talk about how you manage to resolve it?
Whenever I start work on an interior, I like to draw up a floor plan. I like a general arrangement of furniture so that I can understand how the rooms are going to be laid out and how the spaces can interact with each other. And once I've understood where I want my focal pieces to be and furniture groups around them and really how the house is going to be used as the very best background for the people living in it, then and only then, I think, can you start really worrying about colours and things like that. For me, the most important thing is to get the footprint correct. And obviously, then one can work on lighting. You know, are there enough places for lamps, for side tables, or wall lights if you don't have space for many tables? Quite often when I work with a new client, they want to be very excited about colour and, are we painting this room? Is it wallpaper? Maybe we're fabric walling. And I said, to be awfully dull, we have to start right at the beginning and we have to establish how it's going to be laid out. We have to get the nuts and bolts right. Because if that can be resolved, then it doesn't matter what we do, even if we don't have enough money to do all the schemes we want to, it won't matter because the space will work beautifully. And even if we just paint it and make the simplest of curtains, it'll still look wonderful and they will still enjoy it. So I think that for me is the main thing.
That's such lovely advice. So the future, if we may. So now that Sybil Colfax and Beaver have collaborated on this wonderful project, do we have other things that you might think about that we could work together in the future, Philip?
Coming back to what I said earlier, the idea about comfort and making things human is something which we could consider doing in other areas. And I think you yourself have said that somewhere like the Regent Gallery, which although laid out in a way which is quite 18th century with a lot of furniture around the perimeter, it doesn't necessarily lend itself to how you and your visitors might want to use the space. And so I think it's maybe looking at somewhere like that and examining how it could possibly be replanned so that, you know, in a sense, rather than the Regent's Gallery, it has elements of the drawing room or a sitting room about it so that the scale can be made more appropriate for people who want to live in a slightly more casual way. Yes, it's wonderful having state rooms rooms that are formal and, you know, present period furniture and paintings off to their best, but they might not always be the best rooms for sitting and having a cup of tea, putting your feet up and reading the paper. And it would be lovely if you could bring that humanity through to some of the staterooms and the grander spaces. And I think that's maybe how future conversations could pan out in terms of what we could bring to the party and what we could bring to Beaver in terms of moving it forward and not necessarily ignoring the past, but adding to it and using things in a slightly different way so that things become more comfortable.
So for our listeners, I can say if anyone is out there wanting guidance and help, you couldn't come to a more professional and sympathetic and in tune team than the guys from Colfax and Fowler. Emma Burns and Philip Hooper, I have been delighted working with you, and the result has blown away the minds of many of the viewers who've seen it throughout papers and magazines throughout the world. So well done you, and thank you for all your support.
And thank you as well.
It's been a great joy working with you.
Thank you, Orlando, and Emma and Philip, for joining me on the podcast. This has been a wonderful, enriching episode. It's affirmed how much beauty I'm surrounded by in my life, and I must say, I feel immense gratitude. And of course, I'm grateful to all of you as well who are listening at home. So thank you. Next week, on our final episode of this season, I speak about the business of Beaver, past, present, and future, with our wonderful CEO, Emma Stenning. It's a revealing and fascinating conversation, so I do hope to see you there. I just have a few final things to share with you. Please follow the podcast where you listen to them. So to keep up with the times, we've just started a TikTok account. And if you're interested in additional behind-the-scenes content, please follow at Duchess the Podcast. Also, I love to learn more about you and your story. Please write to me at our listener inbox. The email address you need is duchess@duchessthepodcast.com or visit our website. This show was produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the editor and producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Selena Christofidis is the graphic designer. I've been your host, the Duchess of Rutland. And this has been Duchess.